Myself am moved to woo thee for my wife.
Moved? In good time. Let him that moved thee hither remove you hence. I knew you at the first. You were immovable.
Why, what's immovable?
A joint stool.
Thou hast hit it. Come, sit on me.
Asses are made to bear, and so are you.
Women are made to bear, and so are you.
No such jade as you, if me you mean.
Alas, good Kate, I will not burden thee, for knowing thee to be but young and light.
Too light for such a swain as you to catch, and yet as heavy as my weight should be.
That's a scene from Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
In Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, Petruchio tames the stubborn Kate into becoming an obedient bride, while other suitors compete for the hand of her more tractable sister, Bianca. Is this a misogynist play? Why has it lent itself to so many modern adaptations, such as Cole Porter's Kiss Me, Kate, and the film 10 Things I Hate About You? What makes this early farcical play one of Shakespeare's most popular comedies? Joining us to discuss Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew is Richard Knowles, professor of English at the UW-Madison. We also have with us two MFA acting students, Annalise Dickinson and William Boltz.
Welcome back to University of the Air, Dick.
Happy to be here.
Well, we want to pack in as much Shakespeare as we can, but I think first we need to have a little bit of an idea of what we know and what we don't know about this play. What makes it different from other Shakespearean plays?
Well, it's an early play, and he hadn't learned his favorite subject yet, which is the comedy of being in love. This is not about being in love and being uncomfortable at being in love. It's about the uncomfortable relationships that you can find yourself in when you do fall in love and attach your life to someone else's. And so it's a play that begins as a very well-known kind of play at the time, the wife-taming farce. There was a play roughly contemporary with this called Rule a Wife and Have a Wife. And if you do that, then you will knock your wife around and subdue her and make her obey everything you wish her to do. That was not Shakespeare's way, of course. He was used to making strong women characters. He liked strong women characters like Rosalind and like Beatrice in Much Ado. And he was not about to write a farce in which people get punished with all sorts of comic violence. Now, there is a certain amount of that in this play.
In terms of the farcical aspect?
Yes. Kate threatens to break a three-legged stool over the head of one of her suitors. She threatens to paint his face to look like a clown. Petruchio threatens to knock his stupid servant Groomy on the head, and he does wring his ears. Kate ties up and whips her sister, slaps her new suitor Petruchio. She breaks a lute over the head of her music teacher. He's sometimes shown on stage looking through the strings of the lute.
There's the mud scene.
And yes, go ahead.
I was going to ask, does Petruchio ever actually strike Kate, though?
Well, he slaps her back, or threatens to at least, when she slaps him. But no, that's not his modus operandi. He's a much more clever person than that. He is violent to other people, to his servants. He's throwing the clothes around that that the haberdasher and the tailors have produced for him. But that's partly to show Kate what she looks like when she's behaving so badly. That's not his normal way of operating, as far as we can tell. He calls people names, flap-eared knaves, jolt-heads, unmannered slaves, malt horse, drudge, and so on. But on the whole, he's showing Kate what she looks like when she behaves as badly as she has got a reputation for behaving.
So if we're trying to figure out why this play is so popular, even though it in many ways seems dated if you look at the sort of a submission of a woman, you know, the sort of putting her in her place idea. If you look at the popularity of the play, would you say it's because of the sparks between the two lead characters?
Well, certainly it offers a great opportunity to a husband and wife pair, and there have been several of those, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor and Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fonten and others. And the woman's part is strong enough so that she can hold her own against Petruccio's lines and win cheers for doing that.
Well, let's talk about the opening of the play, the induction, before we get to the main play, main part. Why do we start with not even the main story of Catherine and Petruccio?
And why an induction as opposed to, say, an introduction?
Well, induction was the word for introduction there. It leads a leading into the play. I don't know why it was done that way.
Well, guess. What does it add? Let's put it that way. What does it add to the story that we have a frame?
Well, it gives you an excuse. It gives Shakespeare an excuse for putting on a play about wife taming, because he's putting this on for a drunken tinker that a great lord has found lying in the road. And they've brought the tinker home and put him in bed and pretended that he's a great lord, that he's been asleep for years and has just woken up like Rip Van Winkle. And he's been without his wife for a long time. Obviously, Christopher Sly, the tinker, is not himself a very romantic soul. We hear when he is told that he hasn't been to bed with his wife for 15 or so years, that he gets right down to business without any romance at all.
Well, let's listen to that scene. This is going to be Sly, the drunken tailor, who has been told that he has a wife that he has not been with for 15 years.
Hear, noble lord, what is thy will with her?
Are you my wife and will not call me husband? My men should call me lord. I am your goodman.
My husband and my lord and husband. I am your wife in all obedience.
I know it well. What must I call her?
Madam.
Alice, madam, or Joan, madam?
Madam and nothing else, so lords call ladies.
Madam wife, they say that I have dreamed and slept above some 15 years or more.
Aye, and the time seems 30 unto me, being all this time abandoned from your bed.
'Tis much. Servants, leave me and her alone. Madam, undress you and come now to bed.
So how does Shakespeare lead from the scene that we just heard with the tinker and his wife into the play itself?
Well, while they're pretending that Christopher Sly, the drunken tinker, is in fact the great lord, they decide to entertain him as a great lord would be entertained by a play. And the play that they choose is a play that they think will be just to the taste of a drunken tinker, a play about a man controlling his wife, getting her to behave, something that Christopher Sly would have had great trouble doing in his own life, apparently.
Dick, can you give us a sense of the plot here with Taming of the Shrew, the father, the two daughters, and what brings Petruccio to Padua?
Well, Petruccio is down on money, and he wants to marry a rich woman. And so he says very early on that if he has a rich woman, he doesn't care if she's as cursed as Xantippe. Socrates, the very wisest of all men, was not wise enough to avoid attaching himself to a shrew of a woman named Xantippe. There's a story of Socrates having a terrible fight with his wife, walking out the door, and she emptied a chamber pot on his head. And he said philosophically, "I should have expected rain after so much thunder." It's one of the famous examples of the wise man who married a shrewish wife. And Petruccio says he doesn't care if he imitates Socrates, so long as this woman is rich.
Antonio, my father, is deceased, and I have thrust myself into this maze, haply to wive and thrive as best I may. Crowns in my purse I have, and goods at home, and so am come abroad to see the world.
Petruccio, shall I then come roundly to thee, and wish thee to a shrewd, ill-favored wife? Thou'dst thank me but a little for my counsel, and yet I'll promise thee she shall be rich, and very rich, and thou art too much my friend, and I'll not wish thee to her.
Signor Hortensio, twixt such friends as we, few words suffice, and therefore, if thou know one rich enough to be Petruccio's wife, as wealth is burden of my wooing dance, be she as foul as was Florentius's love, as old as Sybil and as cursed and shrewd as Socrates, Xanthippe, or a worse, she moves me not, or not removes, at least, affection's edge in me, were she as rough as are the swelling Adriatic seas. I come to wive it wealthily in Padua. If wealthily, then happily in Padua.
But then, as soon as he sees Kate, and she is a woman of great spirit, and she's causing trouble, and he sees that she's a beautiful woman of great spirit, then he falls in love with her, apparently, and decides that he wants to win her and woo her by winning over this woman, showing that he's not going to be scared off, as all the other men that have attempted her have been scared off, that he admires her, he can see what's good about her, that he's just as tough as she is, and that she's going to have to change her mode of operation. If she wants to get rid of him, she's going to have to find some other way than that.
Well, we'll get right down to it in a moment. That's Petruchio versus Kate in The Taming of the Shrew when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. With us is Richard Knowles, professor of English, and we are talking about Shakespeare's play Taming of the Shrew. And we also have acting Annalise Dickinson and William Boltz. Dick, before we hear this wonderful scene where Petruchio goes after the shrewish Kate, let's talk about his psychology. You know, he's heard her reputation that no one can get through to this waspish, shrewish woman. They want her to marry so that her younger sister can marry. What does Petruchio do in order to break through?
Well, first of all, he shows that he's not afraid of Kate. He's not going to be browbeaten by her. He's going to stand up to her. And when she is fresh to him, he can be just as fresh back. But the other thing that he does is recognize that here is a young woman who all her life has been called by her father and by her sister and probably by her other acquaintances as being a shrew. A shrew is a very vicious little rodent who will snap and fight far more fiercely than its size would lead you to expect. And if everyone has all your life told you that you are a shrew, then why not satisfy their expectations and behave like a shrew? The sociologists call this a self-fulfilling prophecy. But he does exactly the reverse. He says, you're not a shrew. You're very beautiful. You're gamesome. You're energetic. You're fun. And you're not going to scare me by being shrewish, because I see what you really are. You are a beautiful young woman. You are soft-spoken when you choose to be. You are lovely, and there's no reason why you should not be loved as much as anybody else is. Probably Kate, after a lifetime of being told that she's unattractive, is ready to hear this from somebody and willing to adjust to this new set of expectations that's being presented to her.
Good morrow, Kate, for that's your name, I hear.
Well, have you heard, but something hard of hearing? They call me Catherine, that you talk of me.
You lie, in faith, for you are called plain Kate, and bonny Kate, and sometimes Kate the Cursed, but Kate, the prettiest Kate in Christendom. Kate of Kate Hall, my super dainty Kate. For dainties are all Kates, and therefore, Kate, take this of me, Kate of my consolation. Hearing thy mildness praised in every town, thy virtues spoke of, and thy beauty sounded, yet not so deeply as to thee belongs, myself am moved to woo thee for my wife.
Moved? In good time. Let him that moved thee hither remove you hence. I knew you at the first. You were a movable.
Why, what's a movable?
A joint stool.
Thou hast hit it. Come, sit on me.
asses are made to bear, and so are you.
Women are made to bear, and so are you.
No such jade as you, if me you mean.
Alas, good Kate, I will not burden thee, for knowing thee to be but young and light.
Too light for such a swain as you to catch, and yet as heavy as my weight should be.
Should be, should buzz.
Well, ta'en and like a buzzard.
Oh, slow-winged turtle, shall a buzzard take thee?
Aye, for a turtle, as he takes a buzzard.
Come, come, you wasp, in faith, you are too angry.
If I be waspish, best beware my sting.
My remedy is then to pluck it out.
Aye, if the fool could find it where it lies.
Who knows not where a wasp does wear his sting? In his tail.
In his tongue.
Whose tongue?
Yours, if you talk of tails, and so farewell.
What, with my tongue in your tail? Nay, come again, good Kate. I am a gentleman.
That I'll try.
I swear I'll cuff you if you strike again.
So may you lose your arms. If you strike me, you are no gentleman. And if no gentleman, why then no arms?
A herald, Kate. Oh, put me in thy books.
What is your crest? A coxcomb?
A combless cock, so Kate will be my hen.
No cock of mine. You crow too like a craven.
Nay, come, Kate, come. You must not look so sour.
It is my fashion when I see a crab.
Why, here's no crab, and therefore look not sour.
There is, there is.
Then show it me.
Had I a glass, I would.
What, you mean my face?
Well aimed of such a young one.
Now, by St. George, I am too young for you.
Yet you are withered.
"'Tis with cares.
I care not.
Nay, hear you, Kate. In sooth, you scape not so.
I'll chafe you if I tarry. Let me go.
No, not a whit. I find you passing gentle. 'Twas told me you were rough and coy and sullen, and now I find report a very liar. For thou art pleasant, gamesome, passing courteous, but slow in speech, yet sweet as springtime flowers. Thou canst not frown, thou canst not look askance, nor bite the lip as angry wenches will.' Nor hast thou pleasure to be cross in talk, but thou with mildness entertain'st thy wooers, with gentle conference soft and affable. Why does the world report that Kate doth limp? O slanderous world! Kate, like the hazel twig, is straight and slender and as brown in hue as hazelnuts and sweeter than the kernels. O, let me see thee walk. Thou dost not halt.
Go, fool! And whom thou keep'st command.
Did ever Dian so become a grove as Kate this chamber with her princely gait? Oh, be thou Dian, and let her be Kate, and then let Kate be chaste and Dian sportful.
Where did you study all this goodly speech?
It is extempore from my mother wit.
A witty mother, witless else her son.
Am I not wise?
Yes, keep you warm.
Mary, so I mean, sweet Catherine, in thy bed. And therefore, setting all this chat aside, thus in plain terms, your father hath consented that you shall be my wife, your dowry agreed on, and will you nill you, I will marry you. Now, Kate, I am a husband for your turn, for by this light, whereby I see thy beauty that doth make me like thee well, thou must be married to no man but me. For I am he am born to tame you, Kate, and bring you from a wild Kate to a Kate conformable as other household Kates. Here comes your father. Never make denial. I must and will have Catherine to my wife.
Is that the real mastery of Petruchio, that he is such a master of words that he can better her that way?
I think it's a matter of attitude rather than words. I think he sees what he has to do to impress this young woman is not to keep calling her a shrew, as everybody else has, but to instead suggest that she's a very attractive young woman, and that if she will only try to behave that way, he can live with that. That's pretty much what he does when he brings her clothes to wear at the wedding. He is willing to give her all of the fine clothes that she could use, but only if she seems to want them, if she seems to need them so as to appear a lady rather than as a fighter.
And you get the sense that even though she's got this reputation of being a shrew, that she also doesn't want to end up an old maid, and that she sort of agrees to this marriage more rapidly than one might expect.
She agrees very quickly, doesn't she? Mm-hmm. As soon as he announces to the father and the other folks there that she has agreed to marry him, well, she hasn't agreed to anything of the sort, but she doesn't contradict him. This is sometimes done in the movie by his twisting her arm behind her back, but I don't think you need to do that. I think the point is she looks at him in astonishment and thinks for a minute about what it would be like to marry this guy and live with him for a while, and finds that it's not all that bad.
I get the feeling, you know how a really good chess player would be so happy to run into another really good chess player mm-hmm. because then you've met your match and it's not going to be boring. I get the sense when you listen to Kate and Patricio talking that they enjoy this intellectual exchange, the punning, the double entendres. They're witty. They're both witty.
And she has met her match, finally. And he has showed that in his own way, he's her equal. And in a way, he's earned her. He's deserved her, deserved to win her. I remember seeing a movie of Kiss Me, Kate, with Howard Keel and Catherine Grayson. And she did a wonderful act near the beginning, I hate men, and she throws dishes all around the room. And I was sitting behind a pair of young women who were obviously on Catherine Grayson's side. They were shouting, right on, sister! and by the end of the play, they had come 180 degrees around. They were actually cheering for Petruccio. They saw somehow that he deserved this woman. He had earned her, and he was going to be good for her in a way.
Well, let's face it, any kind of forward progress, there has to be some kind of coming together. There's no victory if they go their separate ways.
That's right.
We're going to look further into The Taming of the Shrew when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Richard Knowles, and we're looking at The Taming of the Shrew, a comedy by Shakespeare, and also we're hearing the voices of two actors, Annalise Dickinson and William Boltz. You know, it's sort of a cliche that comedies end with weddings, and yet there has to be more to it in this because we have these two gunpowder personalities coming together. And she, Kate, has agreed to marry Petruchio. But we need to have some idea of how this is going to work. How does the wedding and the honeymoon follow what we've seen so far?
Well, his treatment of her on the honeymoon is not promising. He makes a great scene at the wedding itself. He fights with the priest, throws wine in the priest's face, gives Kate a great big noisy kiss that makes the church resound.
Doesn't he also come late to the wedding?
He comes late and dressed in ragged clothes on a horse that is a disgrace. He looks as though he's not prepared to behave at what should be the most promising moment in their relationship like anything except a brute.
And why? What is his strategy? And, you know, he's already got her to agree to marry him.
He hasn't really convinced her, I think, that kind of behavior is unsuitable. And he's also trying to make the point that if she wants it to be treated like a lady with an attractive wedding, that she's going to have to earn that somehow. She's going to have to behave differently than she has behaved towards him at their first meeting and as she's behaved towards all other men ever since she's starting dealing with men. So he's showing her that this kind of behavior is not going to impress him and that he can do just as badly himself. And then he's going to take her off and sweep her out of the hall. And everyone in the hall is glad to be rid of them, of course. They're making such a shambles of the wedding. And then off he takes her to his house, gets her tired on the way, and once she is at his house, doesn't feed her, doesn't dress her in the clothes that he has bought her, on the excuse that she deserves better than he is offering her. And he scolds the haberdasher and the tailor for not offering his new wife better than they have. And then he decides to ride back to her father's house. And it's there that the crucial moment in their relationship happens. She is just following him along, and an old man comes up the road, and he addresses the old man as though he were a young, budding virgin girl, to see how Kate is going to respond to this. And she finally changes. She sees that if she's going to get along with this madman all for a lifetime, she's going to have to change her ways. And why not have fun doing it? And so, in a way, she makes a game of it. She makes a game of the contest with the old man and shows that she can fall in with her husband's wishes and enjoy it.
And this is the famous "the sun is the moon" scene from yes. Taming of the Shrew.
Come on, in God's name, once more toward our fathers. Good Lord, how bright and goodly shines the moon.
The moon? The sun? It is not moonlight now.
I say it is the moon that shines so bright.
I know it is the sun that shines so bright.
Now, by my mother's sun, and that's myself, it shall be moon or star or what I list, or ere I journey to your father's house. Go on and fetch our horses back again. Evermore crossed and crossed, nothing but crossed.
Forward, I pray, since we have come so far. And be it moon or sun or what you please, and if you please to call it a rush candle, henceforth I vow it shall be so for me.
I say it is the moon.
I know it is the moon.
Nay, then you lie. It is the blessed sun.
Then God be blessed. It is the blessed sun. But sun, it is not when you say it is not, and the moon changes ever as your mind. What you will have it named, even that it is, and so it shall be so for Catherine.
Well, forward, forward. Thus the bowl should run, and not unluckily against the bias. But soft, company is coming here. Good morrow, gentle mistress, where away? Tell me, sweet Kate, and tell me truly too, hast thou beheld a fresher gentlewoman? Such war of white and red within her cheeks. What stars do spangle heaven with such beauty as those two eyes become that heavenly face? Fair lovely maid, once more good day to thee. Sweet Kate, embrace her for her beauty's sake.
Young budding virgin, fair and fresh and sweet. Whither away? Oh, where is thy abode? Happy the parents of so fair a child. Happier the man whom favorable stars allot thee for his lovely bedfellow.
Why, how now, Kate? I hope thou art not mad. This is a man, old, wrinkled, faded, withered, and not a maiden, as thou sayest he is.
Pardon, old father, my mistaking eyes, that have been so bedazzled with the sun that everything I look on seemeth green. Now I perceive thou art a reverend father. Pardon, I pray thee, for my mad mistaking.
Do, good old grandsire, and withal make known which way thou travelst. If along with us, we shall be joyful of thy company.
I think for many women listening to that scene, it's a little bit difficult to hear her saying that the sun is the moon or the moon is the sun, and also difficult with her final speech. Can we hear that final speech, Dick? And can you set that up for us, what we're to think when we hear Kate, I don't know, declaring the role of women as one of submission?
Well, it's a very difficult speech for an actor to know what to do with, for an actress to know what to do with, because in one way it's a medieval speech and a thoroughly Elizabethan speech in its ideas. It argues that the only peaceable marriage can be achieved when the woman is subservient to the man and is willing to do everything that he wishes, and that she ought to be glad to do that sort of thing, because after all, he goes off and fights in the wars, and he goes off and works all day, and he protects her, and it is his job to be responsible for her, and the least she can do is to be nice and obedient to him. This is a very difficult speech for a modern actress to make convincing and persuasive to an audience these days. And so various ways are found of dealing with it. One is for the actress to wink at the audience in her voice, in her mannerisms, and as if to say, well, I have to say these things But we all know in the 21st century how it's going to work out. I'm going to learn to control this guy. Another way is for her to do it absolutely straight. And she is insisting, as she says these words, that it is part of the husband's job to deserve these kindnesses from her. And one of the ways of doing it is for the men in the audience, as they hear her say how she will do her best to treat her husband well, to make them look a little shamefaced and realizing that they're going to have to change their ways, too.
Well, let's hear the final speech of Kate from Taming of the Shrew.
Fie, fie! Unknit that threatening, unkind brow, and dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. It blots thy beauty as frosts do bite the meads, confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds, and in no sense is meet or amiable. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty. And while it is so, none so dry or thirsty will deign to sip or touch one drop of it. Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee, and for thy maintenance commits his body to painful labor both by sea and land, to watch thy night in storms, the day in cold, whilst thou liest warm at home, secure and safe, and craves no other tribute at thy hands but love, fair looks, and true obedience. Too little payment for so great a debt. Such duty as the subject owes the prince, even such a woman oweth to her husband. And when she is froward, peevish, sullen, sour, and not obedient to his honest will, what is she but a foul contending rebel, and graceless traitor to her loving lord? I am ashamed that women are so simple to offer war when they should kneel for peace, or seek for rule, supremacy, and sway when they are bound to serve, love, and obey. Why are our bodies soft and weak and smooth, unapt to toil and trouble in the world, but that our soft conditions and our hearts should well agree with our external parts? Come, come, you froward and unable worms. My mind hath been as big as one of yours. My heart is great, my reason haply more, to bandy word for word and frown for frown. But now I see our lances are but straws, our strength as weak, our weakness past compare, that seeming to be most which we indeed least are. Then veil your stomachs, for it is no boot, and place your hands beneath your husband's foot, in token of which duty, if he please, my hand is ready. May it do him ease.
This speech is coming from a woman who has already learned to say that the sun is the moon and the young is old, and to say anything that might just accomplish whatever she has in mind to move forward. So who knows how to interpret this speech?
Well, that's the reason why in that scene where she is talking to the old man and calling him a young budding virgin, not to make her crushed and broken in her spirit, but to make her playing along with Petruchio and saying that we know we're going to have to go and do a lot of foolish things in our marriage. But it's worth the game. It's worth doing.
If she's been playing the role of the shrew, now she's playing the role of the sort of angel wife. I mean, it's all game playing and role playing, isn't it?
Well, I hope that she's not going to just play. I hope that she's learned that she has to adjust and that she can't go on just screaming at people and throwing things around, but that she's going to have to change her way. I mean, if she is going to be tamed, at least to that extent.
And Petruchio has learned what from all of this? Is he a changed man at the end of it?
Well, he says, "Kiss me, Kate." And that's where Cole Porter gets the title of his musical. He, I think, realizes that he does love her and is willing to live with her.
And perhaps he's no longer just a mercenary guy wanting money.
That's right. He's not just in it for the money at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, a subplot of this play involves the younger sister, Bianca, the one that many suitors want to have. Can you give us a short sense of what that subplot adds to the play?
Well, she is usually played as a blonde, as her name would suggest, Bianca, meaning white. And she is usually played as the little blonde ingenue, the blue-eyed, batting her eyelashes, the woman who just loves having all these suitors. She has so many that she says at one point to Kate, "Why don't you choose which one you want? I have plenty." And that only makes Kate more furious, of course, because she doesn't have any.
And of course, Bianca has to get Kate married off before she can take advantage of any of these suitors.
That's right. And so Bianca is willing to see Kate married to Petruccio. But the young men who are pursuing Bianca are no prizes. One of them, Lucentio, is attractive, and he is willing to pose as her tutor in languages and read love poems to her and will do them with feeling, of course. And she's willing to have this young, attractive suitor reading love poems to her.
And Lucentio seems to fall in love with her at first sight in a more traditional romantic scene.
Yes, this is a perfectly romantic comedy beginning. "Master, you looked so longly on the maid. Perhaps you marked not what's the pith of all."
"Oh, yes. I saw sweet beauty in her face, such as the daughter of Agenor had, that made great Jove to humble him to her hand when with his knees he kissed the Cretan strand."
"Saw you no more? Marked you not how her sister began to scold and raise up such a storm that mortal ears might hardly endure the din?"
"Tranio, I saw her coral lips move, and with her breath she did perfume the air. Sacred and sweet was all I saw in her."
"Nay, then 'tis time to stir him from his trance." He just stares at her and he doesn't hear how Kate is complaining and screaming. All he sees is this beautiful young blonde girl with the blue eyes batting at him, and he falls completely for her and is willing to compete for her. He's competing against a rather unimpressive young man, Hortensio, who also poses as someone he isn't, so as to be in the household teaching Bianca. He's going to pose as her music teacher. And then there's old Gremio, a rich old man who has no business being in the presence of a beautiful young girl at all. But he thinks that he can win her by outbidding her. He knows that her father, Baptista Minola, is very much interested in money. And so his way of winning this girl is to say all the money he has and to try to outbid all the other suitors, the most unromantic of all approaches to marriage, of course. Baptista says 'tis deeds must win the strife, and by deeds he means auctioning off his daughter to the greatest, highest bidder. And Gremio tells what riches he has. "First, as you know, my house within the city is richly furnished with plate and gold, basins and ewers to lave her dainty hands, my hangings all of Tyrian tapestry, in ivory coffers I have stuffed my crowns, in cypress chests my arras counterpoints, costly apparel, tents and canopies, fine linen, Turkey cushions bossed with pearl, valance of Venice gold and needlework, pewter and brass, and all things that belong to house or housekeeping. Then, at my farm, I have 100 milch kine to the pail, 60 fat oxen standing in the stalls, and all things answerable to this portion. Myself am struck in years, I must confess, and if I die tomorrow, this is hers. If, whilst I live, she will be only mine."
That only came well in. "Sir, list to me. I am my father's heir and only son. If I may have your daughter to my wife, I'll leave her houses 3 or 4 as good within rich Pisa walls as any one old Signor Gremio has in Padua. Besides 2,000 ducats by the year of fruitful land, all which shall be her jointure. What, have I pinched you, Signor Gremio?
2,000 ducats by the year of land? My land amounts not to so much in all. That she shall have, besides an argosy that now is lying in Marseille's road. Ah, what, have I choked you with an argosy?
Gremio, 'tis known my father hath no less than 3 great argosies, besides 2 galleasses and 12 tight galleys. These will I assure her, and twice as much whate'er thou offers next.
Nay, I've offered all. I have no more. And she can have no more than all I have. If you like me, she shall have me and mine.
Why, then the maid is mine from all the world by your firm promise. Gremio is outvied.
For modern audiences who might be going to see The Taming of the Shrew at some point, Dick, what would you say you would recommend watching for in this play that would make it unique, the themes that run through it, you know, the different, I don't know, the high points for you in the play?
Well, the thing that always has impressed me is how an audience, a modern audience that ought to be offended by the play, is not, because it deals with a situation which is a fairly general one. People getting together, having to live with each other, have to find a way to adjust and find a way to allow for each other's idiosyncrasies and sometimes bad qualities. And it seems to me that here you have 2 characters who are both offensive to begin with, a mercenary young fortune hunter, Petruccio, full of male pride, and an angry young woman who hates men and screams at them. And what kind of marriage is going to come out of this? It's one of the triumphs of the play that it makes you believe that they are so interested in each other as personalities, willing to deal with each other's anchors and difficulties, that they get interested in each other and are happy at the thought that they are going to be dealing with each other for much longer.
What makes it something where you can tell, even though this is an early play, that this is Shakespeare, that it's not one of his contemporaries, what are some of the qualities that make it stand out?
Well, I suppose it's exactly that quality of the breakdown of the stereotypes, that the young fortune hunter turns out to be a very intelligent and romantic young man who is won over completely by this beautiful young girl, and by the fact that this angry young shrew, a type of a fearful type that would make men doubt that they ever wanted to be married, that this young shrew has quite another side to her too. She has a very gentle and loving side that she wants to develop. She doesn't want to be an old maid. She wants to have some young man cherish her and love her, perhaps even master her. I don't know.
How does this play, if at all, lead into Shakespeare's next plays, his next comedies?
Well, he always was interested in strong women. He must have had some boy actors who could carry off strong women all the way from the earliest plays to Cleopatra at the end of his career.
That still kind of boggles the mind, doesn't it? to think of Kate
boy
and Cleopatra as being played by boys.
Yeah. And he wrote, obviously, with these strong boy actors in mind, because he knew that they would do something different with the kind of character that he wanted to create. Which was an interesting, strong woman, not a subservient, little, meeching, goody-goody housewife.
Well, what's interesting, too, is in the scene where you have the various men who are supposed to call their wives to come, and Petruccio can get Kate to come, but Bianca's husband, Lucentio, doesn't have such good luck getting her to come at his bidding, which seems to be Shakespeare's way of saying perhaps some of those blonde, blue-eyed, you know, seemingly sweet, submissive women are not really all they seem.
Well, it's an interesting scene. He offers several commands to the women, It begins as a wager. He says, "We'll see who is the more obedient wife." And in a way, Kate wins by being more obedient. She wins the money by being more obedient. Lucentio says to his servant, "Bid your mistress come." And the word comes back, "She's too busy to come." Hortensio says, "Entreat my wife, beg my wife to come." And the servant comes back and says, "You've got to be kidding. You have some goodly jest in hand." And then Petruchio says to Kate, "I command her to come." And she comes and puts her hand under his foot to show that she is completely subservient. And then he gives her some more commands. "That cap you're wearing here, throw it under your foot and step on it." "What? Waste this perfectly good cap," says the other women. And she says, "Of course I will do that. Tell these headstrong women that I will do whatever my husband tells me, trusting that it's for my good." And so, in a way, this is Kate's finest moment, because she, by following the rules of the way a marriage ought to go, wins the wager and vindicates herself, shows that she's not just a shrew, that she has changed and learned.
How did this play fare through the ages? I mean, Shakespearean plays, you know, various ones have kind of various highs and lows of popularity over the years. How did Taming of the Shrew fare over the years?
I suspect that some of the subtleties that I've been talking about, the psychological cleverness of Petruchio, got lost in the rough house. There was a Scots play called Sawney the Scot, which was really much more brutal than anything that Shakespeare wrote, in which a Scotsman beats up on his wife and subdues her and cows her and makes her behave. That was not Shakespeare's intent, obviously. The language in the play would tell you that. He gives Kate too many admirable speeches.
Was the ending ever changed as it was with some of the other Shakespeare plays?
Only in being made more brutal, I suppose.
Any parodies of it that you know of? Any feminist parodies?
You know, I don't know of any feminist.
But there was a sort of a sequel, wasn't there, to it? A possible sequel by another playwright. In which Petruchio is a widower, and then he is tamed by his second wife.
I don't know that play.
In fact, it was contemporary with Shakespeare, and I can't remember the playwright's name. I'm going to say 1611, something like that, which would have been, 20 years or so, almost after this.
Yes. I don't know what play you're talking about.
But it was tossed around here and there, I guess, over the years.
I think it's a play that appealed more to men for two or three centuries than it would ever have appealed to women. And only when you get strong actresses like Katharine Hepburn or somebody like that playing Kate that could carry off her aplomb and her distinction, that you would make it a play that women could say, "Yes, I admire that woman."
But at any rate, it would be, I suppose, hard for an actress to resist that role. Because it's somebody just such a wonderful role to play, no matter how you play it.
Yes, whether you play her as giving in to traditional ideas at the end, which is one way of playing it, or as maintaining her spunk and spark to the very end and winning anyway, it will appeal to whether you're an independent woman or a dependent woman, I suppose.
It doesn't seem as if it has quite the poetry of the later ones?
It has very little poetry. There are very few explorings of in-depth of themes like the power of romantic love or the need to be forgiving in love. The quality of mercy is not strained, could never exist in this play, obviously. It's a play which depends on rapid repartee and give and take and a contest, essentially, between two people, which gets resolved to the satisfaction of both of them by the end.
With words rather than blows.
Yes. But the words are never thoughtful words, never meditations on themes about the nature of love and the fickleness of love and the power of love or anything of that sort. It's shown in the give and take of the action that love matters to them and they want it.
but they never talk about it as an abstract subject very much.
And we never come back to the sleeping tinker that was watching this play.
We don't know what happened to that sleeping tinker. It may be that he was just dead drunk asleep and was carried off the stage at the end. He's not given any lines at the end. That's true.
So we have no idea what happens to...
It may be that as the Kate and Petruchio story got more romantic, he just lost interest and nodded off.
Well, that would be very inappropriate for a Shakespeare play, for anyone other than that tinker. Dick Knowles, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.